Derek Jensen, I appreciate you joining us, and I'm going to create a little bit more context here for our audience and also for you calling in. Derek Jensen, I want to share this with the audience. One of my daughters gave me the book, A Language Older Than Words, as a gift for my birthday, and inside the cover she said, I really love this book. I thought you would like it. I love you. And so naturally I read it. And it's something that had a great deal of impact on her, and I found that in reading it that there's a lot of depth in your writing that I truly appreciate. And what I will share in the way of context with the audience is that this is somebody who's a writer on the environment and about consciousness, that we are out to make change, and if we are out to, as they say, sometimes all too often, save the planet, or even stave off some of the things that it looks like are coming at us, we have a job ahead of us of doing some things and understanding our own consciousness and really what kind of culture we're in. So one of the things is that the world is speaking, this is a quote, every moment of every day, and because it does not speak English, we choose to believe it does not speak. That's the earth itself, by the way, speaking to it. And our bodies speak to us too, and we choose not to listen to that. So there's a lot speaking to us, including our dreams. So, Derek Jensen, thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
I have a couple of questions here just to start out. When you have a book that's titled A Language Older Than Words, what do you mean by when you refer to a language older than words, and how did you come to learn of the existence of a language that's, like as you say in your book, other than English and older than words?
Well, I guess the what I'm talking about with that is that we, the whole world is speaking to us all the time, and this culture systematically inculcates us into not listening to our own bodies, not listening to the voices of those around us, humans and non-humans alike. And I mean, really, that book was supposed to be originally when I was going to write that. I started thinking about the book maybe 16, 17 years ago, and wrote it in 97, so it's 15 years ago. And then it took a few years to get published. But anyway, the originally it was supposed to be about how a lot of us experience interspecies communication all the time, but we don't talk about it. We talk about it in private, but we don't talk about it in public very much. There's this taboo against believing that non-humans can effectively communicate, but a lot of people are experiencing it every day. And just the most basic example might be, you know, I've said this to so many people. So, if you have a dog,
yes,
how does your dog let you know that its water dish is empty? Well, it looks at you, looks at the water dish, looks at you, looks at the water dish.
Yes.
And eventually, we figure it out. A great example of this actually is I had a dog a long time ago that, right now at this moment, I'm at my mom's house and I park at my mom's house and then I walk into the forest to my place, and my dogs would come down with me, and they would sit on the porch. And then if it was time to go home, they'd get up and walk back with me. And if I was going to get in the car, then they would not even bother to get up from, they would just keep lying on the porch. And it took me probably, I'm going to guess, a year to figure out how they knew whether I was going to go home. I thought it was like some magic cosmic, ESP thing. But then I realized that they knew the difference. If I'm carrying a key, then I'm going to get in the car. And that's just a real simple example. We can talk about more other examples in a moment. So I was going to write a book about this happy book about all our interspecies communication and showing that a lot of people experience it. And then I realized pretty quickly that I didn't want to write that book for a couple of reasons. One of them is that our relations with non-humans at this point are pretty terrible for the most part, and to write a happy book about it would be dishonest. And also, because I realized that to write a book that purports to show that non-humans really can think and really can speak would be really bigoted, and it wouldn't challenge the underlying bigotry of this culture, in that it would be like writing a book that purports to show that blondes can think or that Jews aren't subhuman, in that it would still maintain that we're the one who determines whether they can speak or not. It's like it's both horribly sad and also it's just dreadfully ironic that, you know, they will put apes into mobile homes and then teach them sign language, and then there's all these arguments among people about whether they're really speaking or whether that's whether they can really communicate or whether they're just mimicking, and on and on. But the
right.
questions nobody asks are, which of these creatures between the scientists and the apes are really bilingual? You know? The apes are actually learning American Sign Language, and if a bunch of apes kidnapped a bunch of scientists and put them in mobile homes, how quickly would the scientists learn the language of the apes? You know, they never flip
sure.
it. And so I realized pretty quickly that what I really wanted to write about is about how before you can exploit somebody, you have to silence them.
Yes.
And how this culture systematically silences women, children, other species, other races, our own bodies. And a quick example of that is I used to work with this guy whose mother died of a staph infection, the antibiotic-resistant staph infection, when she went in for just a minor surgery. And, of course, it was his mother, so I never pushed this, but it did come up in conversation a couple times that antibiotic-resistant staph, one of the reasons it's happening is because of the massive use of antibiotics in feedlots. And he refused to make the connection,
oh.
even though it killed his own mother. Or another way to look at this is that, you know, a joke I tell that's not very funny is, what do you call someone who attempts to put poison in the subways of Tokyo? You call them a terrorist, and you put them in prison forever. And what do you call someone who conspires to put poison in the ground water of the United States? You call him a vice president, and it's Dick Cheney. You know, if it's an oil and gas man, it's fracking. So there are ways that we systematically don't listen, and we don't even listen to our own bodies. And I want to tell, and this may be a bit too much information for people, but it's just a really great example.
It's okay.
Of this
is the show for it. We tear away the veils here.
Okay, great. a really great example of a way our body can speak to us is probably 5 or 6 years ago now, I got this really bad prostate infection.
Mm-hmm.
And the first sign I had, which I didn't know was a sign, okay, so I'm just living my life normally, and all of a sudden, this is just warning, you know, too much information here, but all of a sudden I got incredibly obsessed with masturbating. And I was just like wearing my arm out. I was like, what's wrong with me? This is crazy. And then a couple weeks, like a week or two into that, I started having a lot of pain down there, and I'm thinking, man, I messed myself up or something. And I went to the doctor, the urologist, and he said, well, you've got a prostate infection. I said, well, so what's the deal with this weird sort of thing that happened? He said that was like sneezing, that basically the prostate knew it was infected and wanted to get the infection out. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes. And by the way, listeners, we're going to pretend that we're talking to Dr. Oz here.
Okay, there we go. That'll make it all okay. And so the point is that I just thought that there was this weird thing going on in my head, but instead it was my body it was like a sneeze, and it was trying to get this infection out. And I didn't know consciously what was going on. And that's just a really good example, and a kind of embarrassing example, frankly, of what I mean by this language older than words. And one last example one of the things I say is, so have you ever made love? And if so, did your partner have to say, okay, now you do this? No, chances are pretty good you're reading the other person's body.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
we all experience this on a daily basis, that there are languages other than words.
Yes. In fact, it can go even into levels of being empathic. It can go into levels of there's this dance of life where if people start to become aware of that, they can be, chi dancing is like that. There's all kinds of movement that you can have where it's just an intuitive kind of movement together. And if I'm reading a language older than words, and I'm reading it correctly, that you're seeing that there is the potential for that dance in with trees, with fish in the water, with birds. And you've done it with coyotes, that you've been able to just have cooperation with them by talking to them.
Well, I think it's absolutely normal.
You're saying that we can have this intuitive dance of movement and of consciousness, like of speaking and listening with trees. You can pick up a rock and feel the power in it. You can feel that with birds, you know, the way that they just fly around in these formations. And you tell the story a few times in there about your experience with coyotes and your chickens.
Well, it's, I think so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really, really is. And another way to say this is that generally people in the dominant culture perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And this is really crucial because
yes.
I love the lines of R.D. Lang where he said that how we behave in the world, I'm sorry, how we perceive the world affects how we behave in it. And it's really true that there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills.
I see dollar bills, right, right. There's
and
a lot of
I,
that
if
these
If when
days.
I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way.
Mm-hmm.
And if when I look at trees, I see trees, I'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. You know, if when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently. Well, still, this is the essence of really what's wrong with this culture is this resourcification of the entire world, perceiving
mm-hmm.
all these others as simply how you can use them. It's really sociopathological. Or as having interactions with them and being able to hear them. One of the ways I think about that is that a few years ago, I was at my mom's and I was doing laundry. And I'd finished doing laundry, and I was just folding up the sheets. And she came over and she said, "Would you like some help?" And of course, we have a long, long relationship. And what she said is, "Would you like some help?" And what I heard her say, based on, you know, all these years of parent-child, parent-adult-child relationship, is, "You're doing it wrong." And so the conversation went, "Would you like some help folding your sheets?" "No." And then she walked away.
I'd rather
What's
do it
wrong
myself.
With you?
Yeah.
And so my point is that even when we both speak English, we still have plenty of room for projection.
Yes.
And so, you know, you can have two people say to each other, "I love you," and one means one thing and somebody else means something else entirely. Something that probably many of us have experienced at one point or another. So there can be a lot of room for projection if we both speak English. And now let's take it a step further and say, let's say that I speak English and you only speak Italian. We can probably still communicate through common human gestures. Probably one example that comes to mind is I read that cross-culturally, when people flirt with each other across almost all cultures, one of the things they might do is meet eyes briefly and then glance down into the side. And so that would be a common human language that I speak English and you speak Italian,
right.
Then we can still communicate, but there's going to be more room for projection.
Right.
And then let's say if I speak human and you are a dog, then suddenly we're both still speaking mammal, but and we both know, I'm presuming if you've encountered dogs a lot, that you know some of the stuff with dogs. You know, if they growl, we
mm-hmm.
know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
If they wag their tail, we know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're not speaking human. And then we can take this on down further and further away until, you know, obviously if we attempt to communicate with a tree, there's all sorts of room for projection, even more. But I think about one of the things that an indigenous friend of mine said one time. I said, "Where do dreams come from?" And she laughed and said, "Everybody knows the animals give them to us." You know, that's really counter to everything we hear in Western society about dreams come from the unconscious or whatever.
Right.
And so my point is that there's huge room. I'm sort of preempting about projection by saying, of course there's projection. But the question is sort of really one of our central goals in life, I think, is to figure out what is projection and what is not projection and to attempt to experience this wonderful symphony that is life around us.
Wow. You've introduced a lot of thoughts here. And by the way, this is a bilingual radio station. And so I, myself being a native English speaker, and many of my colleagues here are native Spanish speakers, we do have those moments of where we're working through the part that is where I do not know all the right words. And where if I listen and watch the person talking to me and we do it mutually, we can work out and understand each other what we're saying. There's a lot that gets absorbed if you're simply listening and just being present and conscious to what's going on. So that's my way of relating to what you're describing here.
Oh, can I tell you, that's great. That's great. Can I tell you another story?
Sure, certainly.
Years and years ago, it's probably, gosh, a long, long time ago, 20 years ago, something. I was dating someone in a not very happy relationship, and she was picking fights quite often, and I couldn't figure out why she was picking fights all the time. At the time, I had a couple of dogs, and I also had chickens, and if the dog food was out during the day, the chickens would eat it. So I would always leave the dog food. I would not feed the dogs until after dark. And at the time, I was teaching at Eastern Washington University in the evening. And one day, I forgot to feed the dogs before I left. So when I got home, there was chewed up cardboard all over the garage floor. And it occurred to me immediately, if I were a dog and I was really hungry and I was upset that I hadn't been fed, how am I going to express this? Well, I might chew up some cardboard, and because that was a way to express the discontent. And
right.
Suddenly it hit me that, you know, if I were dating someone and wanted to break up and I couldn't do it, what would I do? Well, I might pick fights all the time. And so
yeah.
That's just another example of this language that is beyond just what is consciously recognized.
We are in a conversation here on Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio, with Derek Jensen, who's the author of A Language Older Than Words, and actually 12 books, including one that came out late last year about dreams, and a lot of commentary about where we're headed is, I mean, when you talk about dominant culture, you're talking about coercive, you're talking about something that's really out to destroy and could be destroying the whole habitat that we live in and is busy working on it, too. So I'd like to pull some of your ideas about that, Derek Jensen, a little bit about where do dreams come from and how do they play into this whole way that we can become conscious in a way that affects this dominant culture that we're in.
Well, dreams have always been really important to me. And for years, I wanted to write a book that would be... Originally, the idea was for it to be sort of almost a collection of short stories, but each one would just be a dream that I had had. And it wouldn't be every single dream. That'd be kind of... I wouldn't want to put that on the people. But instead, it would be sort of big dreams that I had had. And then the whole thing would coalesce into some sort of... when you read the whole book, it would be like a mosaic that would show some picture when you step back. And I started to write the book, and I never wrote that book for a long time because it seemed really self-indulgent, because this culture is killing the planet, and so, you know, why would I want to write about that? And then I realized that, you know, I said earlier that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous peoples generally perceive the world as consisting of other subjects with whom we can enter into relationship. And that's one part of it, but I've also never heard of an atheistic indigenous culture. And indigenous cultures generally would fall into the more of the category of animistic. So I really got to thinking about this and thinking about the relationship between, once again, how we perceive the world and how we behave in the world. And the book ended up, first we went with too much information, now we're going to use a really big word, which was the book ended up getting into epistemology, which is how we know that something is true. The reason I ended up there is because I was trying to explore this whole question, do trees speak? What do dreams mean? Do dreams come from somebody on some other side, or do dreams come from our unconscious? Where do they come from? And I really got to the question of how do we know? And there's this great and terrible line by Richard Dawkins, a scientific philosopher. I can't stand him. Anyway,
he's an atheist.
He's very influential. And there's this line that is, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. And that's really extraordinary, because what he has done with that statement, and it's true in a sense, you know, if I turn on this light, then, you know, if I flip the switch, I know light's going to come out of this light bulb. You know, that's making matter and energy jump through hoops on command.
Right.
But the problem is that one of the problems is that what he's done is he has conflated, this is really sneaky, he has conflated how we know with the ability to dominate. And it's based on the presumption that everyone else are just, that matter and energy are just objects that we can coerce into doing whatever we want.
Right.
And the important point I'm trying to get at
here, we know truth by how we manipulate.
Yes, that's one form of knowledge, but it's also true that one form of knowledge can foreclose other forms of knowledge forever.
Right.
And a great example of that would be if you and I were in the same room and I pull out a gun and I hold this gun on you and I say, I want you to jump through a hoop now. well, I've got a gun on you, so you do it. What do you know? I'm a genius because I predicted you were going to jump through the hoop, and then you did.
That's
it.
Right. That's
but in
right.
so doing, haven't I destroyed any possibility of friendship with you? Don't
yes.
you think you might resent me or hate me for
yes.
enslaving you?
I think of the Maya. I think of the library in Alexandria being destroyed. I think of things like that.
Help me understand, so how's that fit?
That's a case where the science that the Maya had was totally destroyed, in at least a lot of it. They were very advanced and scientific, and they knew a lot about astronomy, and yet as soon as the conquistadors came, they just destroyed everything that they could find. And the Library of Alexandria was something where the popes of old went in and just destroyed this library because there were things in there like that the sun is at the center of the solar system and really, really weird science like that. And yet they were able to destroy, and their science won out for a couple of centuries after that.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example. And so dreams ended up being really about that. How do we know what is true? And then also about if it is simply true that a lot of indigenous people have talked about the importance of relationships to ancestors or to those on other sides, or however we want to put it. And if that's true, that they really did have these connections, if there are those on other sides, why is the dominant culture winning? Why has white culture been able to systematically conquer indigenous peoples the world over? And so
mm-hmm.
I start asking, is it true, the sort of the scientific materialist worldview, that the entire world is dead and just, you know, there are humans who are somehow thinking matter? And is that the case? Or is it the case that maybe the Christians are right and there is only one God, and this God is really jealous, you know? So maybe that's true. Or maybe, you know, I go through all these possibilities and I was talking to an American Indian friend of mine, a Dakota friend, and she said, you know, this is a question that, so far as she knows, you know, basically every indigenous person has been asking for the last 500 years, that
yes.
how is it that the dominant culture keeps winning? And so really that's one of the questions that it's central to that book. I mean, and one of the things that's happening, and it's pretty clear, you know, should be pretty clear just from our conversations about these two books, that one of the things that I end up doing in all my work is, you know, I start with some subject, and then I keep trying to open it out to larger and larger and larger context. You know, if I start off about interspecies communication, and I end up talking about, you know, everything, and I
yes.
start talking about dreams, and I end up talking about everything. And one of the things I'm trying to do with that is I'm trying to show that we do, that it's, I think it's really harmful to, I think that the monopoly, I think that rational thinking is really just a part of life, and it's an important thing to do, but I think the monopoly that sort of narrow-focused, lack of context thinking is one of the things, again, that's really killing the planet. Because if you focus on, for example, how can I maximize profits, well, you know, we see where that heads. So what I think is really important is to keep trying to open out to the larger context at every moment. Not at every moment, because then you just sort of explode, you know, we existentially explode if you open out every moment. You know, I can't walk around all my life considering that every single person I walk by has hobbies and, you know, a pain in their leg and everything else. I mean, we have to narrow down sometimes, but it's nice to be able to open up once in a while.
And so I really hear that part, that the maximizing profit is killing the planet, and seeing everything as a dollar sign is killing the planet. And I hear also you saying that there are indigenous people that you talk to that are sometimes mystified by how this keeps on happening. And have you been able to get any ideas from your exploration as far as what is causing that? Is it just because of power and money, or is there something about the, well, what do you think?
I wish I knew.
It's something's just happening.
I've written a lot of books on this, and it's, you know, at one point I thought that part of the problem, and I think this is part of the problem, but it's a lot more than this, that part of the problem is, in a language of the words, I talk about how part of the problem is that I think we have an entire culture that's suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is we're so traumatized by this culture that many of us lose the ability to be in relationship. One of the things that happens with complex PTSD is people can come to believe that all relationships are based on domination. If you're, say, a long-term prisoner, if you're raised in a domestic violence situation, you can come to believe that all relationships are based on, you know, being a perpetrator, a victim, or a bystander. And that's not, if you have not been raised in that circumstance, or if you have not been held in captivity, then that would not be your experience. And one of the things I say there is I think we have an entire culture that has forgotten how to be in relationship. But then that wasn't sufficient, because it's like, they're killing the planet. I mean, it's way worse than that. So what could it be? And in Culture Make-Believe, I talk about how basically what you do as a society, what you reward as a society is what you're going to get. And so if you reward fundamentally antisocial behavior, if you reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, if you reward acquisitive behavior socially, that's what you get. If you reward behavior that benefits the group as a whole and disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, that's what you'll get. So the social reward system of this culture is all messed up, too. That's still not sufficient. And honestly, at the end of the day, the best explanation I've ever heard, I mean, because it's absolutely crazy.
Yes, it is.
This insatiability for destruction is just... Yes. Well, there's two explanations that make a lot of sense to me. One of them is a fundamentally radical feminist perspective, which is that within patriarchy, one of the ways that men are validated as being men is by defining some other as inferior and then violating this other. And this, so you can, and then when you violate this other, that validates your superiority.
Yes.
Because you were able to violate them.
We see it in racism. And
we see it everywhere.
Yeah.
We see it. That's the only thing that can help me understand why they had to bomb the moon, you know, because you always have to find some new thing to violate. And that's one of the reasons it ends up being insatiable, is because there's always someone new to violate. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And then another thing that makes a lot of sense, it goes kind of a different direction, is there's this guy, Jack Forbes, wrote this great book called Columbus and Other Cannibals, in which he talked about how he thought the problem was, and this is not a metaphor, he's not speaking this metaphorically, but literally true, that there's a spiritual illness with a physical and spiritual vector. And what he meant by that is if I have the flu, I can get flu symptoms, and then I cough, and I can give you flu symptoms.
Right.
But he said there's a cannibal sickness, a spiritual illness that is contagious and can be caught by others. So if you have the cannibal sickness, then you give it to me, then I have to consume the souls of others in order to survive. I become basically a vampire.
Wow.
And I love that. Well, I hate it, but that actually... It honestly makes more sense than anything I've ever written, because, once again, I can't... You know, there are stolid scientists who are at this point saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish within 40 or 50 years. It's one of the things that lets me know that there's not going to be any sort of voluntary transformation is the way the dominant, like the governments and corporations, have responded to the melting of the Arctic. And they've responded not with horror, but instead with...
Let's go get
what
it.
What I can only really describe as lust to get at the the access to the minerals and to the Northwest Passage.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely terrifying. They're not trying to stop it, but they're instead trying to figure out how they can maneuver themselves to get access to, you could either say, A, these new reserves of minerals, or you could also say these new places to violate.
Yes, it's the new agenda of all the really great things that climate change is bringing to us. And especially things that it makes it possible to conquer more and produce more oil. And when I think of that vampire thing, vampire of the soul, I think of Dick Cheney and his poisoning the earth with the oil. That was not more than a metaphor as well when you were saying
that.
This is Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio. And my guest here, I'm your host, Daniel Kirbine. The guest here with me is Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words and Dreams, and 10 other books about the environment and consciousness. We're talking about a dominant culture that has turned everything into a dollar sign, and the meaning of manhood has been turned into what can we conquer and exploit and destroy. So I have a couple of things with my guest here, Derek Jensen, the author of Language Older Than Words and Dreams. So for you, Derek, I have a question about, well, I saw recently where you had published a declaration. It was like a declaration of independence, and it was, we hold these truths, really screed, kind of a manifesto about the environment and about what we really need to be going forward. And I'm wondering if you would like to comment about that. Am I correct about that? Did I read that correctly? Because I thought I saw it.
Absolutely. I just I covered a lot of ground in that, and I'm wondering specifically if you wanted me to comment on that.
Yeah, there are things happening like with Occupy movement, and there are people actually starting to get their voices and starting to gather together. And in fact, I understand that you had actually addressed an Occupy Oakland group at one point.
Yeah, I addressed I think four Occupies. Occupy the Machine in D.C., Oakland, San Francisco, and then Seattle. And one of the things I say in that article that was recently published in the Occupied Wall Street Journal is I just list off what seemed to me some pretty straightforward. I think what's the language from the Constitution? We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That's from the Declaration, yeah.
So some pretty self-evident truths. That,
right.
Like if you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, and that local economies are more important than a global economy, and limited liability corporations shouldn't exist, because if you're going to cause some action that has such great potential for harm that you can't cover it yourself, then you shouldn't do it. And I wrote years ago about the explosion at Bhopal and the release of mass toxic gases. And one of the lines when I was researching it that really struck me, that was one of the most brilliant things I've ever read, was one of the people working for the victims of Bhopal said that you should not be allowed to create poisons for which there is no antidote.
Amazing.
And if, you know, that we can talk about that on the specific level of Bhopal, but we can also talk about that on the larger scale, that no one should be allowed to make a mess that can't be cleaned up. And
yes.
I think...
Isn't that amazing?
You know, if we can go back to sort of the level of kindergarten-style teaching, that's a lesson that we all should have learned in kindergarten and that should be applied to the larger culture, that no one should be allowed to make a mess which can't be cleaned up. And the big thing becomes then that because this government is really set up to facilitate the making of these messes, it becomes the necessity of those of us in our communities. If we want our communities to last, we need to disallow the making of messes for which that can't be cleaned up. And this gets to the heart of what it would look like to what a democratic social system would look like, and
yes,
what a democratic economic system would look like is one in which local communities are not prohibited from stopping these distant economic entities from destroying their local area.
And just like the Declaration of Independence went right down to fundamental issues and points, what you're saying here is very fundamental. You can't make messes that cannot be cleaned up. You can't dump poison into places where people live. All of
calling a person illegal takes away their humanity. We can join our voices to ask media and government to drop the I word now. The I word derails real conversation about immigration and human rights.
Just this week, the president spoke glowingly of illegals.
Illegal aliens are in the country, including many murderers and rapists.
It's racially charged, legally inaccurate, and morally wrong.
Hello, you're illegal!
And as we've seen in the past, hateful language can be deadly.
Illegal functions like a racial epithet. It's a way of legitimizing violence against a particular group of people because of what they are. That's the definition of a hate crime.
But we can stamp out this slur. No human being is illegal. Let's drop the I word. Sign the pledge at droptheiword.com.
And welcome back to Shift Shapers, Pole Reversal Radio. I'm your host, Daniel Curbine. It is now 5:03, and I have as my guest here on the phone, Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words and a newer book titled Dreams, I just want to share one thing and create another little context for the 6 o'clock hour. The manifesto of Shift Shapers Polar Reversal Radio is to, number one, tear away the veils on the stories that were being told by authority, and also to prepare and create the new communities that we're going to need going forward as we start to be hit by climate change, well, we already are, and also the depletion of resources, particularly oil and other fuels. So with those kinds of challenges in front of us in creating new communities, I just want to lay that context out and say, what would you say to our audience regarding what's in front of us? What is the work in front of us?
Well, I think that the central thing I would want for people to think about is a couple of things, I guess. One of them is that 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species will go extinct tomorrow and the day after. We are in the midst of a Holocaust. And even if we only care about human beings, the human beings who come after us are not really going to care about whether we wrote a bunch of books, not going to care about whether we had a really did really interesting interviews, and they're not going to care about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, not at all. They're not going to care about whether we recycled. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. And what I mean by that is that the health of the land is primary, and because without healthy land, you have no life, and we have forgotten. This dominant system has systematically inserted itself between us and the source of life, so that it is true that our food comes from the grocery store and our water comes from the tap. But what is really true is that ultimately they come from the real world, and it's not any sort of esoteric matter of saving the planet. There's going to be people alive 40 or 50 years from now, and they're going to be wondering what was wrong with us that we didn't fight for all we're worth as the world's going down. So everyone who's listening to this radio program must love something. One of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done.
Yes.
And so, you know, I have this friend who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York, and I would never have said to her that she needs to stop doing that and start trying to save salmon because men are beating on women. And
right.
She does wonderful work with that. So whatever it is that you love, dig in and defend it and do something. You know, the big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who do not. The big difference is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And
wow.
So once again, there must be something you love and start. Oh, but tell one real quick story.
Certainly.
This is the smartest thing I ever did. This is how I got started in activism. In my mid to late 20s, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gasoline because of ecological and social effects or social consequence of using gas. So what I decided is for every dollar that I spent on gasoline, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization, not a big one, but a local one. But I didn't have any money. I was desperately poor. And so I decided instead that I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism, because the problem is these problems are so big. How can you possibly get started?
Mm-hmm.
But this was a tangible thing. At that point in the 1980s, you know, filling a tank with gas cost about $10. I'd fill a tank with gas at the time about once a week. So that means $10 worth. So that means 2 hours at $5 an hour of activism. And I didn't let my ignorance stop me. I just said, okay, I got 2 hours to spend. I started off writing letters to the editor. Then I started participating in demos. Then I started doing timber sale appeals. And I started having so much fun that I stopped keeping track because I love doing this work so much. But it was so important for me to somehow get off my behind and get started.
Just to get started, yeah. And another thing that I'm curious about is, what does adaptation for, because sometimes I ask people, I talk to people in the transition movements and things of that nature, what does adaptation for survival in the new world look like? As we start going into a world of climate change, into a world where things become unpredictable that used to be predictable, what does adaptation look like? Do you have any ideas on that?
I did a talk up in British Columbia once where after the talk, the next day, they had me go talk to the city council. And I live in Crescent City, which is extremely conservative, so I was kind of scared. I was like, why are you going to have me go talk to these people? They're going to hate me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty cool because the city council there was actually denying building permits based on global warming. And
wow.
They were actually doing what a planner should do, which is plan for the future, a city planner. So on one level, we need to prepare for what's coming. So there's three levels I want to talk about this. There's the first level is we need to just start thinking about what's going to happen and start planning for it, whether it's,
yes.
You know, you would think that if you have an entire culture that's based on the use of oil, that you'd think about how you're going to live without oil. So there's one level at which we just need to start. It's like a doctor friend of mine says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. So
yeah.
We need to look at the reality that we face before. It's like a doctor comes in and says, you got emphysema. What are you going to do now? You know? It's like you got to make some decisions. So we got to look at that first. We have to look at reality before we can choose how we're going to adapt. That's the first thing. The second thing is, honestly, I don't so much care about adaptability in terms of how I adapt to the future because I'm not as important as what's going on in the real world. And
wow.
Also, I have Crohn's disease, and I am dependent for my life upon high-tech medicines.
Okay.
And as this culture collapses, I'm going to die. So I don't say this blithely, but that's not a good enough reason to keep it going. What's most interesting to me is I'm going to die anyway, so the survival of the salmon is more important than my survival. Years ago, somebody asked me, so would you take out a dam if you knew it was going to kill those you love? And I asked a couple of people very close to me at that point. I said, I don't know, I got to ask them. And I asked a couple of people close to me, and they both said, you sure better said yes, that you'd take it out anyway. It's like, I'm not as important as the land base. That's crucial for us to understand. None of us are as important as the land. And then my third answer is, I have a friend who does environmental work who says that the reason he does the work he does is because he wants to make sure, as things become increasingly chaotic, that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if grizzly bears are still around in 30 years, they may still be around in 100. If bull trout are still around in 30, if coho salmon are still around in 30, they may still be around in 100. If they're gone in 30, they're gone forever. But there's another aspect to that that's very important too, which is we need to recognize that the American empire is collapsing. And it doesn't matter whether it's collapsing because of greed at the top or because of peak oil or whatever reason it's collapsing. The truth is this current system, capitalism, is collapsing. And as things collapse and become more chaotic, it's desperately important that we make sure that some doors remain open, by which I don't just mean that coho salmon survive. What I also mean is that if you want to know what happens when a patriarchal civic society begins to collapse, look at the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is just what happens, that when a mill closes, domestic violence rates go up. As civic society collapses, women become more often the targets of male pattern violence. And so I have two pieces of advice for that. For women, it's learn self-defense and learn it now. Don't learn it later. And for men, what we need to do is we need to make our allegiance to women absolute, and we need to have a zero-tolerance policy now for violence against women, because we need to instill these values before things become chaotic so that when crazy things happen, we can be prepared for them. And it's not just true for men's violence against women, but also for racial violence, that
yes.
It is predictable that as people's entitlements are threatened, as people's privileges are threatened, as an economic system collapses, it is predictable that racism becomes more overt, because those whose privilege was maintained prior, as that privilege starts to erode, they're going to look for scapegoats. And the easy scapegoats are, as the advertisement just said a minute ago, those illegals. I'm using that word as an epithet,
yeah.
Just like in the ad a moment ago. We could have predicted easily sort of this rise of the Tea Party with the collapse, with the descent of American capitalism. This is just what happens. And the time to fight that is now. And we need to have a zero-tolerance policy. I don't know what race you are, but I'm a white person. And as a white person, I need to make my allegiance to victims of white supremacism absolute now.
Yes.
And so that's what I mean by when I hear about preparedness. I'm not so interested in having a year's supply of food in my closet. That's fine. But what I'm really interested in is making sure that we have in place those principles that we want to live and fight and die by and for and with.
Well, profound words from Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words and Dreams, and 10 other books as well. Derek Jensen, how can people find your books, look them up, see what works you have done, and blogs, etc.? Can you give us some sites?
Well, I have derekjensen.org, DerekJensen.org. People can go there. And they can also buy my books from, if they want to buy books, they can buy them from independent bookstores. Please do that over Amazon or from me, whatever. There's also, I've got a ton of essays up on my website. So that's the quick version on how people can learn more about me.
That's terrific. That's terrific. And we thank you very much for having joined us here on Shift.
Well, thank you for your great questions. Let's do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to also mention to our listeners that we have a podcast here, Shift Shapers. It is at www.blogtalkradio.com/shiftshapers, so you can find us right there.